Welcome back to Introduction to International Relations. This optional lecture will build off our discussion of collaboration problems and systemic forces, examining whether and when we can expect leadership from the most powerful state in the system on threats to the global environment. The first slide, as always, provides the goals for this lecture. First, I'm going to discuss the tragedy of the commons, which helps to clarify why man-made threats to the environment continually emerge, which it's sad to say, they do. Climate change is not the first such crisis we've faced, nor is it likely to be the last. There's a particular type of collaboration problem that has plagued human societies for centuries, if not always to the same degree. We'll consider the classic formulation and then ask how things change when the actors vary in their use of the commons to such a degree that a single actor can easily determine whether it will be overutilized. We'll then apply the insights from that discussion to some real-world threats to the global environment. Okay, turn to the second slide. As it says there, we've got a lake that 100 families fish from daily. Experts warn that if more than 200 fish are caught per day, it's certain that the fish population will collapse, and it'll be years before it recovers to levels that would allow these 100 families to survive off the lake again. In reality, these sorts of warnings are never so precise, and they're not perfectly reliable even when they come with a range of acceptable levels rather than a sharp dividing line between sustainable and crisis-inducing. We're going to proceed as though it's possible to know exactly where the problem kicks in, simply because that makes things easier to explain and lets us avoid the need for calculus. Given that warning, which again, we're treating as credible despite its precision, simply because that allows us to make a point that holds up more broadly without needing uglier maths, each family has to decide whether to try and make do with fewer fish than they're used to. Let's imagine that one particular family has always tried to come home with 3 fish at the end of the day, and they have some way of knowing that fewer than 198 fish are being caught per day. There's not going to be a problem either way, in other words. If they catch 2 fish, they get 2 times the average utility of a fish, which I've cleverly denoted F, plus the benefit of knowing their future's intact. If they catch 3 fish, they get 3F, plus that same benefit. Easy choice, they go for 3 fish. Now suppose they have some way of knowing that the other families are catching so many fish that the doomsday scenario envisioned by the geeks with their clipboards and university degrees is going to come about even if they don't catch any fish. Sure, they could cut back to 2 just to show that they weren't the ones who caused the problem, but what would that really get them? 1 less fish. If the future's gone either way, the only relevant comparison is between 2F and 3F. Again, that's a pretty easy choice. They go for 3 fish. But what if they somehow knew that precisely 198 fish are being caught per day? I know, that's crazy unrealistic. Again, the proper way to model this would involve calculus, which I can't assume all of you are familiar with, so just roll with it. But your skepticism is warranted, and indeed the absolute implausibility of knowing that the next fish you catch will be the fish that ruined an entire community's way of life is going to be an essential part of the story in just a few minutes. Bear with me. In this case, and only in this case, our hypothetical family has a strong incentive to show restraint. If they catch 3 fish, disaster ensues. If they catch 2, everything's fine. So unless the present value of that 3rd fish outweighs the benefit of knowing that their way of life will continue, they'll hold off. They might have to limit themselves to 2 fish a day in perpetuity, but at least there will be fish for them to catch. I haven't put hard numbers on beta or F, but the story I'm telling pretty clearly implies that most people would settle for two fish in this case. But again, we had to assume that it was possible to tell whether one additional fish would make all the difference. And that's wildly implausible. Not only would the experts never have claimed that a single fish would matter that much, but there'd be no way of telling how many the other families have caught. Maybe all 100 families really do believe that the fish stocks are under too much pressure. There's still the problem, though, of knowing whether any one family's decision of whether to catch two as opposed to three is going to make the difference. Actually, it's worse than that. If they're more analytical than emotional, and capable of looking at things as they are, rather than blinding themselves with how they think the world should be, they'll quickly arrive at the answer to that question. It won't. When everyone thinks that way, though, problems arise. Because no one fish will make a difference, but 200 a day versus 300 a day is a big deal. I've presented the argument in terms of fishing. The British economist who first identified this problem, a bloke named William Forster Lloyd, focused on sheep grazing a pasture. It doesn't matter what metaphor we use, though. The fundamental problem, that everyone is likely to behave, quote, selfishly, unquote, when they don't think their individual behavior makes much difference, which they're absolutely right to believe in many cases, helps to explain why human beings have hunted several species to extinction, the collapse of several ancient civilizations, polluted rivers, smog, and many other tragedies. Can this problem be overcome? Absolutely. And it often has been, especially on a small scale. Laws can be passed, communities can work together informally, and norms can develop that encourage more responsible behavior. Don't get too optimistic, though. We're in the midst of the worst environmental crisis in history right now. Many people are aware of that, and a lot of symbolically important steps have been taken so far, but some pretty bleak scenarios remain all too plausible. You might be tempted to think that's because of climate skepticism, which is embarrassingly rampant in my home country, but the point I'm trying to make here is that we can't expect everyone to adjust their behavior even after we convince them that the problem's real, because there's still a problem of individual incentives. Most people aren't going to settle for 2F when 3F is readily available, unless they're quite sure that they're going to ruin everything by catching one more fish. Is that depressing? Absolutely. Does the fact that you don't want to believe we live in a world where people are that selfish constitute any sort of reason for rejecting this argument? I really don't think so. The behavior I'm describing isn't even that selfish. My claim is that most people are reluctant to give up lives of comfort and plenty when their individual choices have next to no impact on anything anyway. Though I acknowledge that a good number of us are willing to do the right thing when our actions are more than symbolic, or when the sacrifice is relatively modest. Consider, then, that one study had groups of various sizes participate in an experiment that had the same basic features we just discussed, and came to pretty depressing conclusions. 16 four-person groups, 2 3-person groups, and 1 2-person group were asked to play a repeated game that combined elements of the Tragedy of the Commons with the Centipede game from our third in-class activity. That is, each round, the participants could draw resources out of a common pool. If none of them did so, it would double in size. Otherwise, it would remain the same. Meaning, there would still be resources next round. There was no complete collapse in this experiment. However, it only took a single person drawing from the pool to prevent it from doubling, which should strongly discourage selfish behavior. What happened? Well, the 2-person group let the pool double each round, which I guess is something, but none of the larger groups did. And note that we're only talking about 4 people needing to work together here. I understand that many of you find it hard to believe that people act this way, but honestly, the evidence is all around you. You just have to allow yourself to see it. There are, however, ways of solving the problem other than trying to guilt trip everyone, or the vast majority of people, into making personal sacrifices. Turn to the next slide. We've now got a much larger lake being fished by 200 families, as well as some medium-sized fishing companies and one huge conglomerate. Each of the families can catch up to 3 fish per day. The medium-sized companies, M1 through M3, can catch up to 200. The huge conglomerate, H, can catch 1,000. This lake isn't going to get overfished to the point of population collapse unless more than 2,000 fish are caught per day. Again, we're going to treat that as a sharp dividing line just to keep things simple. The substantive implications wouldn't change much if we used a more realistic setup, but the maths would. Let's focus on H. Suppose they expect everyone else to fish to the extent of their ability. That means they expect 1,200 fish to be caught every day before they even account for their own efforts. 200 families catching 3 fish per day is 600 fish, plus another 200 for each of the 3 medium-sized companies. The question then becomes whether H decides to stop fishing each day after catching 800 fish, or to try to catch the full 1,000. We can ignore every other option because H is out to make a profit. They might be willing to call it a day at 800 to preserve the population of fish, but there's no reason to pull up their nets at 500 or 600. And if they decide to ignore the warnings about overfishing, they're not going to catch 801 or 900 or 950. They're going to go for the full 1,000. If, and only if, the benefit of being able to continue fishing this particular lake is greater than the short-run payoff of catching an additional 200 fish, the huge conglomerate will show some restraint. That's a little different than before. On the one hand, a huge conglomerate isn't necessarily going to go out of business if a single revenue stream dries up, so they might not be as worried about overfishing as a family whose entire way of life depends on the population of that lake. On the other hand, it's much harder for them to conclude that their actions don't make a difference. Earlier in this lecture, I told you that you were right to question whether a family could know that the next fish they caught would cause a disaster. Here, it's a bit unrealistic that H would know that 800 is perfectly safe, whereas 801 wouldn't be. But they catch so many fish each and every day that they have to know it's in their power to determine whether the lake gets overfished or not. What exactly they'd have to do if they decide to care about that is a bit more complicated than I've suggested, but the important point here is that when a common resource is being utilized by actors of fundamentally different capabilities, one of whom dwarfs all the others, then the depressing conclusion that no one's going to change their behavior because they all think that their individual choices don't matter breaks. Now we've got at least one actor who knows for a fact that their choices do matter. I'm not saying we should always expect huge conglomerates to make the right choice, not by any means. Rather, the point of these two models is that we should generally expect common pool resources to be overutilized, to the point of an environmental disaster that might come in the form of species extinction, desertification, fields going fallow, rivers drying up or becoming unsafe to swim in, or whatever. When a large group has access to it, none of whom makes use of the resource to all that different a degree than the others, and no central authority regulates the use of that resource. Sadly, that description often fits international relations. However, it doesn't always, particularly because of the middle part. Sometimes the most powerful state in the world, which I referred to as H for hegemon, in the lecture on systemic forces, has the power to determine whether real harm is done to the environment or not. When they do, they will sometimes take action to protect the environment, other times they won't. What we want to focus on is how big a sacrifice they'd have to make if they want to solve the problem single-handedly, or spearhead an initiative that would lead to its collective resolution, which would still require them to bear a lot of the burden. Turn to the last slide, and let's get into some real-world applications. In recent years, the world has faced two strikingly similar challenges, which nonetheless saw very different resolutions. In the late 1970s, scientists noticed that the ozone layer was depleted. During certain months of the year, it grew so thin around the poles that people began to speak of a hole in the ozone. Prior to that, the ozone layer had played a critical role in blocking UV rays from the sun. As it depleted further, scientists argued, the risk of skin cancer would increase sharply. You've probably heard about climate change. If any of you question the science on that, let me briefly talk about what we know and what we don't. Skeptics sometimes say that the projections are all based on computer models, which aren't even that reliable. That's true. They also say the climate has changed before. That's also true. However, what they don't seem to appreciate is that it's not true that this is all guesswork. Precisely how warm the planet will be 30 years from now, never mind at the end of the century, is open to debate. But the link between CO2 and re-radiation of infrared rays, which increases air temperature, can be shown analytically and reproduced in the lab under controlled settings. If you question that human activity plays some role in this very complex system, you're about a nose hair away from saying you don't believe 2 + 2 = 4. There's simply no room for debate about this, at least not amongst reasonable people. There absolutely is room for debate about the magnitude of the effect, because there are so many other moving parts. Warmer air temperature leads to more water evaporation and more cloud cover, which in turn partially offsets the higher air temperature. Melting polar ice caps interrupts the Gulf jet stream, which has actually led to a slight cooling of Western Europe and the British Isles, and so on. And it makes a huge difference whether we expect the planet to warm by 2 or 3 degrees Celsius by the end of the century, that's the low end of current predictions, as opposed to 8 degrees, unlikely according to those dreaded computer models, but not implausible. Changes at the low end would require some real adjustments, and that would cost us economically, but they'd also be pretty manageable, at least for wealthy countries whose population lives mostly inland. For small island nations, the debate about whether climate change is real ended some time ago, as they're already watching their countries literally disappear. Changes at the high end would be absolutely catastrophic, though, if not as bad as Hollywood doomsday scenarios with sharks flying out of tornadoes. So I'm not saying you have to believe the most alarmist account out there. Some of them are as far removed from the scientific consensus as denial of climate change is. But the planet is getting warmer, and at a rate that is truly unprecedented. That line about the climate having changed before is incredibly misleading once you realize that they're talking about much smaller changes on a much, much, much longer timescale. We still don't know how big the problem is, in other words, but we know there's a problem. And we know what the primary cause of it is. Incidentally, I should note that a good chunk of the public was skeptical about ozone depletion as well. It seems some people refuse to believe that certain problems exist. In psychology, there's a whole literature on system justification, or the psychological need some people have to believe that we live in a just world whose political institutions, economic systems, and social orders are working properly, because even entertaining the thought that it might be otherwise fills them with a deep sense of guilt over the fact that they're not trying to fix any of those problems, which they know, deep down, they're only willing to devote so much effort to. I mention that because I'm about to tell you that the world took action to address the threat posed by ozone depletion, and it worked. The Montreal Protocol, a UN convention that aimed to phase out the production of chlorofluorocarbons and other chemicals we release into the air that were believed to be responsible for the problem, was eventually ratified by every member of the UN, as well as the EU as an independent body, and world production of CFCs and the other harmful chemicals has indeed fallen off. Scientists now say that the ozone is healing and is on track to make a full recovery by 2050. Job well done. Which is probably why you never even heard about this. If you'd been born a generation earlier, though, you would have. It was all anyone talked about in the 80s. Literally, the only thing. Big hair, Star Wars movies, Dirty Dancing, nah. All ozone, all the time. Believe me, I was there. I was a little kid, but I was there. The Kyoto Protocol, a UN convention that aimed to roll back CO2 emissions to 1990 levels, at least for the most developed states, has been far less successful. Most countries have signed and ratified the protocol, but a lot of them don't face binding targets, and those that do aren't all on track to meet them by the target date. Some countries, like Canada, have pulled out. Others were on board during the first round, but never even participated in subsequent rounds, like Japan, which, as you might guess by the name of the protocol, hosted the original summit. Most importantly, the United States signed the treaty in the late 90s, but never ratified it, and isn't likely to do so. Why did the world succeed in solving one of these problems and not the other? Why did the United States, specifically, lead the way in developing alternatives to CFCs and brokering an international agreement to ban them, whereas it has taken a more conservative approach on climate change? Think back to our two models of the tragedy of the commons. I argued that they tell us we should expect the commons to be overutilized, leading to environmental harm, when everyone's making relatively equal use of the resource, or when the one actor who has the power to make a difference isn't willing to give up the short-run benefit of extracting all that it can. How does that map onto these two crises? Pretty well, I think. In the 1980s, the US produced roughly 30% of the world's CFCs. It would be a stretch to say that the US was largely responsible for ozone depletion, but it was far more responsible than any other one country. Accordingly, when DuPont Chemicals began to fear the sort of lawsuits over skin cancer that later devastated the tobacco industry because of lung cancer, alternatives were developed in fairly short order. The US didn't stand apart from the rest of the world as much here as H did in our second fishing example, and some of the most important actions were taken by corporate entities within the US, though out of self-interest, not altruism, rather than the US government. But we can still sort of say that this is a case where H had the power to make a difference and decided it was willing to do so. I should, however, say that CFCs were not essential to DuPont's bottom line. It hurt them a little in the short run to abandon them as quickly as they did and bring alternatives to market before they were fully viable, but I don't want to exaggerate the level of sacrifice that was made. If this is like H deciding not to overfish, well, then their maximum haul wasn't all that much larger than the sustainable one anyway. That's the biggest difference with climate change. It's not the only one. The US is only responsible for approximately 15% of CO2 emissions, or half its contribution to the CFC problem. And even China, which is now the worst offender, accounts for less than 30%. So while the burden isn't distributed evenly, climate change provides an even poorer fit to that second example, where a single actor recognized that it was pretty much up to them to decide whether the resource would be overutilized. Ozone depletion didn't fit perfectly either, though. Again, the biggest difference concerns the level of sacrifice. The only way to get CO2 emissions down to 1990 levels, which is what the Kyoto Protocol asked countries to do, would be to give up modern technology. Alternative energy sources are becoming more and more viable with each passing year, and may replace fossil fuels altogether in the future, but we're not there yet, and by the time we are, a lot of damage will have been done. So it shouldn't surprise anyone that countries didn't rush to cut emissions back in the 90s, when doing so would have required a very dramatic change in our standard of living. I'm not saying that was the right choice from an ethical standpoint, nor am I saying that those who think it was appropriate to make gradual adjustments, waiting for alternative technologies to develop further, are clearly in the wrong. I'm just trying to help you understand why we see what we do when we look at the world. Man-made environmental challenges have always been with us, and new ones will arise in the future. You should expect them to be handled quickly, without much harm being done, when they're either small enough in scale that people are forced to accept that their individual choices have consequences that aren't negligible, as they sort of are when it comes to climate change, even though I'm not supposed to say that, or when a single country can make all the difference without making much of a sacrifice. In other words, if a disaster can be averted by spraying something other than aerosol into our hair to make it real big, cool, Mother Earth can breathe easy. If everyone needs to start biking to work, eating less meat, and using half as much electricity, which might even mean putting our phones down once in a while, forget it. The planet is doomed.